Well, hey, it's a take three. Thank you very much indeed for being a subscriber and a Vanguardista. Welcome. This is take 3689. I mean, we call it take three, but, you know, there's loads of us. And we appear in your inbox on a regular basis. And we have... You're right, Mark, by the way?
No, I'm all right,
yes. I was just checking. Yeah. It's question schmestions time.
Question smestions.
We definitely made the right call with that one,
definitely.
Didn't we? It's so the best.
Now, if I was listening, I would now go backwards 30 seconds just so I can hear it again. Yeah. So let's do our own version of that and play it again.
Question smestions.
Questions and questions in just a second. Before we begin, this from John Burton. Dear Remy and Anton, in take three this week, questions, smestions, when discussing the film Ratatouille, Mark was trying to untangle the riddle of what the simple dish that the critic ate at the end of the film Ratatouille was. He wondered if the meal at the end of Ratatouille was a pasta dish. Or maybe the critic at the end of Ratatouille was eating another sort of simple meal. Perhaps this could be opened up to the audience or a competition question. Correspondents could email in with a subject line of Ratatouille dish and complete the line, I think that the dish at the end of Ratatouille was...
Thanks, this really so should have ended up in Dumb Britain in Private Eye, shouldn't it?
Gareth says...
It wasn't until reading that it was...
Dear Twit and Twit, hopefully you got hundreds of emails... telling you the same thing. A plate of pasta. Good grief.
But can I just say, you were involved in this discussion as well, and you didn't leap in and go...
Well, I kind of suddenly wasn't sure.
I know. I wasn't sure either. Yeah.
Now, this question is in broken English.
Okay.
Because Emma Burns and Elamiek Schlotten are Dutch, and they are from the Student Creative Business Media Information and Communication Centre. Okay. In Saxion.
Okay? Where? Saxion.
Well, yes. My name... So the email goes like this. I will read... So I'm not trying to be disrespectful in the clunky English. I'm just saying this is what
and
they're
saying. Can we just begin by saying, if you or I had written a letter to either of these people in...
Dutch. Yeah. Which, as you know, is part of Scandinavia, then it would have been...
Exactly.
Atrocious.
Imagine the pig's ear we would have made of that.
My name is Elamiek Schlotten. I'm a student at Saxion University of Applied Sciences in Enschede. The Netherlands. Enschede, the Netherlands.
Okay.
Together with a fellow student, Emma Burns, we are doing research about the British film industry.
Ooh.
Okay. You see, we are researching, quotes, what is typical British in films and series.
Ooh.
End of quotes. We would love to talk to someone who critically looks at the effects, style of filming and English stereotypes in the British film industry. Our three questions are...
Okay.
Question one.
It's a broad church.
What are the main things you focus on while watching a series or a film that you have to give a review on?
Well, I mean, the way that I've always approached reviews is I think that there are, firstly, you have to actually adequately describe what the thing is. And that includes like getting its name right and, you know, accurately describing it. Is it a film? Is it a TV program? Is it an is it adapted from something else? You have to situate it. What does it relate to? Where does it fit in the landscape of other material? How well does it do what it does on its own terms? Like if it's a horror film, is it frightening? If it's a comedy, did it make you or people around you laugh? And then lastly, what you thought of it. So I think those first four things are actually much more complicated than anyone would imagine, and they are generally the thing that trip up most, you know, most people who say, I want to get into film reviewing. And you go, okay, but there's a groundwork that has to be done.
Question two, what's the most common and recurring thing you see while reviewing?
What's the most common and recurring thing you see while reviewing?
Yes. I think that's a little bit vague. Maybe we've lost the meaning of what, maybe it's the...
I suppose you'd have to say that the most common thing you see while reviewing is a three-act structure that actually demonstrates that, I don't know, the name of the guy who I know Jason is a fan of, you know, the guy who writes the, is it Robert McKee, whatever the guy's name is, who does the screenwriting things. It is astonishing.
Is it McFarlane?
Is it McKee? Isn't he?
Robert McKee. McKee, that's fine. Him.
It is astonishing how many films actually do have a three-act structure when you consider how complex, I'm not saying all films by any means, but I'm saying if you're asking what's the thing that you most regularly see happen, it is that a three-act structure is astonishingly common.
Final question, Emma and Elmeet getting value for money here. Hmm. What is a typical British ingredient in a film or series that makes it typically British?
I'll reply to that by quoting Ken Russell. Ken Russell's autobiography was called A British Picture. And the reason it was called that was because Ken Russell's mother used to say, "Is it a British picture?" And what she meant was, is it boring, drab, black and white, somehow uninspiring? And what she meant was, as opposed to a Hollywood picture, which will be bright and full of stuff and interesting. And one of the reasons that phrase, a British picture, became the title of Ken's autobiography was because Ken always argued that that idea of what a British film is not what British cinema could or should be. And there has always been a very strong argument, and Ben Wheatley makes this point very well, that there are two threads of British cinema that he is influenced by. And one of them is the kitchen sink realism, and I suppose in television, you know, Alan Clark, Ken Loach. And the other is this area that Ken Russell is in, which actually goes back to Powell and Pressburger, and this kind of fantastical element of British cinema. And the point that was being made was there is no such thing as a British cinema sensibility. You can have Ken Loach and you can have Powell and Pressburger. And the problem is that nitwit French filmmaker who said, "Oh, the words British and cinema are somehow mutually, you know, exclusive." Yeah. If you haven't seen any films, you halfwit.
Yeah. And increasingly into 2022, 2023, it means there isn't a typical British
ingredient. There absolutely isn't. There absolutely isn't. And I would argue that there never was.
This from Carl, Guardian reading, tofu eating, wokerati and proud. Carl here, he says, you know, Carl, turns out I have a question. It's a simple one. Are, inverted commas, they making fewer films now? I'm not sure who they are, but like most of your listeners, no doubt, for me, movie watching is a mix of going to the cinema, subscription services, streaming rentals, the latter often being a Friday night treat for a film that either got missed or just didn't quite meet the cinema bar, but is still one to watch as soon as possible. Here's the problem. When the weekend comes around, the choice of new movies just seems to get thinner and thinner. It's often a list of straight-to-DVD or recycled recent classics. I know that the way we consume is ever-changing, but I wonder, is this the slow death of cinema manifesting in the not-so-steady stream of new releases? Could it be true that a lot of the talent that was making film 5 or 10 years ago has transitioned to television production, and that's where the budgets are?
No, they are not making fewer films. The issue has always been to do with distribution and exhibition. Actually, if anything, probably statistically, more films are getting made if you include the wide range of movies going right down to super low, ultra low budget, because obviously right now there will be somebody completing a feature film on a DV cam, or not even DV cam, on a, you know, there'll be somebody sitting in a bedroom in Slough who's made a feature film. It's 90 minutes long. They shot it at home. It'll never see release, but it has been made.
There are 20 films out next week.
Yeah. And those are the ones that are getting released that are on the FDA list. So no, they are not making fewer films. They are making more films. The issue is always to do with where they are released and where they can be seen. It is definitely true that a lot of people are making a lot of television, but it's not like there's a limited amount of creatives and these people are making television, therefore there's a vacuum behind them. No, there are plenty of feature films being made, and I would argue probably more than there ever were before.
Carl from Johannesburg, The Mist just jumped into my Netflix algorithm the other day.
Oh, did it? Wow.
And my mind immediately flashed back to that ending. Got me thinking, what would you, gentlemen, can you mention, what would you say about the ending?
Well, we brought it up last week because somebody sent in a schmestion No, well, question. On the subject of if you could go into any scene of a movie, what would it be? And we were joking about whether it's just because you want to be in the Kaylee in Local Hero, or whether it's because you'd want to stop somebody doing something. And you had a suggestion of going to, there was a film that you said in which you'd go and say, just don't do that thing and everything will be fine. And then we both went, or being there at the end of the mist and going, it's all right, the army's coming. You know.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it the team that brought you Shawshank Redemption?
Frank Darabont, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, of course, Frank's preferred version of The Mist is black and white.
Anyway, says Carl, what would you gentlemen rate as the best endings of all time, without spoiling everything? One example which leaps to mind is The Lives of Others by Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, a.k.a. Yep. Florian Henkel, who, when I Googled him to check on the spelling of his name, appears to have transformed into a tall version of Amadeus. Anyway, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind also has a great ending and a great writer, despite his interview skills, that'd be Charlie Kaufman. He also mentions The Usual Suspects, Seven, and Shawshank. Perhaps you and listeners can recommend more obscure
titles. Well, Shawshank
titles.
Is not a good end.
I think it is. Okay. I'm very happy with the boat polishing scene, and you're not, I know. Okay. I would say the first thing that jumped into my mind when asked for a great ending, an awesome ending, was One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, because it's the first film which I saw at Warwick University Film Society where people stood up and applauded at the end.
And that amazing music that plays out as he runs. And then the thing I always remember is the bit with Christopher Lloyd going, ah, 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 and he suddenly pulls that face like a general, and it's an amazing moment.
It's 6,000 gigawatts of power.
That's right.
Phil Goldfinch.
Hang on.
Okay, yes. Yeah,
no, but I think that is a very, very good example. But
I think what I mean by good ending here is it's literally the last 20 seconds of the film. Yeah. It's not a wonderful final scene of reconciliation and we all love each other and we live happily ever. I don't think it's that.
So
I think it's like the equivalent in a novel. It's you're turning onto the last page and you still don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So the two that I'm going to go for, both of which are modern examples, the very ending of Punch Drunk Love, which we did a watch along for.
Yeah.
And the very ending of the Jim McBride Breathless, which has got the best final, you know, here's Jean-Luc, stick that in your pipe and smoke it. That's how that film should finish.
Phil Goldfinch, age 43 and 6 months. Dear Disc and Jockey, I'm a Vanguard Easter second time emergency mailer, MTL colonial commoner from the land down under, living in the frozen tundra, USA. So interesting. I'm interested to know what each of your favourite movies are that include a radio DJ. I'm thinking along the lines of Pump Up the Volume, The Boat That Rocks, No.
The Boat That Rocked.
The Boat That Rocked. Good Morning Vietnam, for example, or perhaps even movies where a DJ plays a part in the main narrative, like Sleepless in Seattle. I hope Simon can send a WhatsApp to my old manager, Tom, who introduced me to the parish many years ago. Hello to Jason, up with the BHFs, down with the patriarchy. Pump Up the Volume, I hadn't heard of for a long time. I interviewed Christian Slater for that. This is back
for Radio 1?
Yeah, for Radio 1. And Radio 1 days, he's known as Hard Harry.
Hard Harry, that's right, yeah.
Pirate DJ. I don't remember thinking that the movie was great. And I think it's one of those things that if you're in a particular industry, you'll always watch it in a movie. It's not like that. It can never be like that. But my answer to you, Phil, is actually you have mentioned it, because Good Morning Vietnam, where Robin Williams plays Adrian Cronauer, I went to see that. And also in the room were a bunch of other Radio 1 DJs. We were all just in awe of a guy who, obviously, he's not making that stuff up. He's a stand-up comedian, you know, and he's and a comic genius. So I think, and also the soundtrack of Good Morning Vietnam has, the CD has got some of Robin Williams' links in it, which bear repetition. So and interestingly, as I'm sure I mentioned to you before, my brother did a documentary about Adrian Cronauer, and there is no archive footage of him at all saying anything, and he's now a Republican congressman or something like that.
Astonishing.
Anyway, so I think they used the name and then that was it. So I would go with Robin Williams. So what would you contribute to radio DJs in movies?
Well, the two things I'd like to cite is at the very beginning of Fisher King, he's a radio broadcaster who That's how the whole thing begins. That he says something that then has terrible consequences. And actually, that film always struck a chord with me, because that idea of he's on air, he says something flippantly, and it has terrible consequences. That always struck a chord. The erotic thriller Night Rhythms, I remember Kim Newman describing it as the ne plus ultra of the erotic thriller genre, the plot of which is that if there's a late night DJ doing a sexy DJ talk, a murder happens on air in the studio and everyone hears it happen. And then the rest of the film is the investigation. And to quote Kim Newman said, if this had been any other genre of film, the person under suspicion would have spent the next 90 minutes, you know, checking matchbooks and, you know, going to tracing down leads and following stuff up. No, because it's an erotic thriller. He spends the next 90 minutes having sex with 2, 3, 4 women at a time until finally Delia Shepherd gives up and says, I did it because I'm a lesbian. But the standout for me is American Graffiti, because the whole American Graffiti, because it's so woven into the story. If you remember, the mission is...
Another soundtrack album, which is great.
Exactly. And I think the soundtrack album does feature... Is Wolfman Jack on the soundtrack
album? Wolfman Jack is on the soundtrack album.
And I think it's so brilliant the way that they weave the thing in about... He has to go and make... Remember this? He goes there and then he says he's not here. It's just tapes. And then... Anyway, that's genius, because it's actually part of the story.
The most frustrating thing about... We can't play this stuff because it would cost a fortune.
Yeah.
But in the American Graffiti soundtrack, they've got a clip of Wolfman Jack doing a phone call and then a voiceover to get into Fannie Mae by Buster Brown, I think it is. Okay. And it crashes. They crash the vocal. So the music starts underneath it. And instead of just editing it so that he hits the vocal perfectly, he crashes the vocal, which is like the thing that you would never do. Terrible. So this is the one that I misread.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Sangeeta in Sheffield. What is your most... So I thought Sangeeta wrote, what is your most controversial opinion? And I thought that was such a great question, because it immediately puts you on the defensive, because by its very nature, you're not going to want to share. Some people are thinking, I'm not definitely not going to tell you my most controversial. What Sangeeta actually wrote was, what is your most controversial musical opinion?
Yeah.
Which is a whole other area. So there was I thinking, what is my most controversial
opinion? You've actually been really thinking about this, haven't you?
Yes, I have, because what is the most controversial thing you'd say to your family that you actually, I think this, or to your friends, or if you're doing a podcast which could be listened to around the world, what is the most controversial opinion that you have? And, you know,
Did you come up with an answer?
Well, I was going down. I think
We will do the other bit. We will do the musical
controversial
as well.
Well, I think I don't even know if this is controversial. Okay. I think you should abolish the House of Lords, for example, and I think
that's not controversial.
I think I liked Patch Adams, and
that's an opinion
for which I think you could be fairly vilified. but then I was thinking, but that's sort of not good. So the only area that I've ventured into, which is so far away from what Sangeeta was originally intending, was I ended up with going down the assisted dying route and the big campaign for dignity in dying and to have choice and end of life. And Australia and New Zealand are setting the example here. And mm-hmm. I just think this has got to come over here. And again, I think a lot of people will agree with that. It's just that the politicians won't go there. So I don't know whether that's controversial.
The fascinating thing about this, and again, just to put this in context, is that we had a little bit of preparation for this, because I hadn't seen Simon since last week. And I was just at your house last night for an hour before, you know, that we just talked about what's been going on. And you mentioned this. And I said that my own feeling about it was that anecdotally that is not a controversial opinion, because I was struggling to think of anyone that I know, although clearly that is a very, very, by its nature, self-selecting group, who doesn't think that assisted dying and that
choice at the end of
exactly. Life. So in my experience, I don't know anyone who has said to me, no, human life is sacred and only, you know, and I know there are other arguments as well, I understand, but everyone I have spoken to about it in my circle, which obviously I understand completely, yeah, is of the opinion that, and certainly many people I know who have experienced very painful end of life circumstances with loved ones, you know, I struggle to think of anyone who has said definitively, no, I just think that any form of assisted dying is wrong. I think you and I are on the same page, but I think you're right when you say politicians won't go there. I suspect that anecdotally it's not controversial, although clearly there'll be people listening to this who completely disagree, and that's absolutely, you know, of course, they're right. But I don't know that amongst our peers it is a particularly controversial opinion.
Undercutting all of this is the fact that I misread Sangeeta's question.
I know, which we will come to.
We've ended up talking about something which she wasn't asking
about. And if I can just, in a not flippant way, you know, you said, you know, your controversial movie opinion is that you like Patch Adams. And if the question was controversial movie opinion, I would say, well, firstly, I know the fact that I now say The Exorcist is the greatest film ever made, not the greatest horror film ever made, which I kept being corrected at for ages, but the greatest film ever made.
How can it be the greatest film ever made whilst not being the greatest horror film?
No, what I mean is it's not just it is the greatest film ever made. When I started saying it, people used to say, oh, you mean the greatest horror film? Okay. I said, no, I mean the greatest film. And bear in mind, I've been saying this for decades. I mean, for decades. And when I started saying it, which was, I think, the 1980s, everybody laughed. Everybody just thought it was a stupid opinion and it was just Kermode being difficult and, you know, saying something for effect. I would like to say that if after all these decades, the one thing I think I have demonstrated is that I meant it, I'm still saying it, I haven't wavered from that opinion. But the world has changed to the point when you no longer get laughed out of court for saying it because people's opinion of The Exorcist has transformed over the years. And the other thing is, I think that Breathless is better than Abu Dussuf by a million miles.
Do you have any controversial views?
I don't know if this is controversial at all, because this again relates to something else that you and I were talking about. My opinion is, it doesn't matter whether or not, sorry, this sounds so pretentious, but you asked me a question, I'm trying to answer it. I don't think it matters whether or not there is a God, whether or not there is an afterlife, whether or not there is a deity, whether or not there is another. I don't think it matters. And I don't think it matters what you believe, as long as, and this is something that you said yesterday, you are kind and you try not to be bad. I actually think everything else doesn't matter.
Yeah, and a friend of ours has this is so far off Sangeeta's question.
Sorry, but...
No, that's very, it's very interesting. People are now going to be taking this opportunity to ask us all kinds of weird stuff. Yeah, there's a friend of ours who has this poster which says, work hard and be kind, which sounds like... Yeah. Pretty much all you need. Anyway, so what is your most controversial musical opinion? I am going to go first because this is just a personal... Yeah. In my opinion, the music... I like John Denver more than I like Oasis. That's it. That's okay. All I've got. I would rather put on a John Denver album than an Oasis album.
Yeah. And mine is the Comsat Angels are a much better band than Joy Division.
Well, these are exactly the territories which we're heading to with questions. Finally, before we're done, and please keep your questions coming in for our next bout. Anita in Glasgow, which country has the best food?
Oh.
So while you're thinking, because I've had the
You've
benefit
thought about
of
this, okay.
Which country has the best food? My honest answer, just based purely on my experience, the answer to that is London. Because London is like...
not a country.
Well, it is, in my opinion. London is another country. And you can experience so many different cuisines from around the world, probably more than in New York, probably more than most places that I've ever... So I would say first London. But if I'm going to be specific, I would say either Italy or America. I love Italian food. It's based on what you like. I love Italian food. And I love the range of food that you get in America. But that, so that's my rather predictable offering outside of London.
And mine, with more exceptions than it is possible to list, would be Japan.
Well, I've never been to Japan, so I would like to go to Japan.
Yeah, I have eaten.
I don't like sushi. Is that a problem?
Yes.
Okay, I won't go to Japan then. Thanks very much. So your excellent questions and schmestions, please, for our next Take 3. Correspondence at kermanomeo.com.